Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends read the books they love and watch the movies they love and talk about the traces of the one reality that we find underlying it all.
Mm-hmm. And boy, have we got some of that today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when we first started to put together this podcast, we were trying to come up with a name. We came up with A Good Story is Hard to Find because kind of a play on Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man is Hard to Find, because we both like Flannery O'Connor, despite how rough her stories are.
Yeah. And yeah, these stories were written in the, you know, I should know all this stuff, but 50s maybe?
Yeah, 40s? Yeah, 60s as well.
60s. Yeah. And they can match things written today for tough subject matter and shocking things that happen. And yet the surprising part is that she's a Catholic writing stories for people who don't know about God, as she says.
Yeah.
So these books are intended to kind of shake you open.
That's right. That's right. So our plan today is, we took the book A Good Man is Hard to Find and Other Stories, and we have no chance to discuss every one of the stories, so we picked three. We're going to talk about A Good Man is Hard to Find and The River and Good Country People. And so we'll try to get all three of those in this hour or so.
Yeah, at least the basics.
You know, we usually try to do kind of a spoiler-free section at the beginning and then move on. But in this case, we're just going to move on. I think that, you know, if you'd like to read the stories, go ahead. But there's really nothing we can say about a short story that's, you know, spoiler-free. And again, I mean, these stories have so many dimensions to them that, you know, it may help to listen before you read.
I think so.
Yeah, so we're just going to go ahead and get on with it.
Yeah, and we're also using the, because I don't want to scare anyone, because I think you could just read these stories, but this either shows I'm not as smart as I think I am, which, okay, we know that's probably true, but it also shows the complexity of her stories, is that I got done reading all these, and after each one I go, what just happened?
Yep.
I don't know what she's getting at always. I mean, some of them you do, but a lot of the times you're just like, these are stories you just kind of have to let sit and think and then read them again. And so we're also using The Habit of Being, which is the letters of Flannery O'Connor, which is this huge, thick book, but so enjoyable because it's just all her letters organized by time and by what she was writing at the time. And they're not all about that. I mean, sometimes it's about life on the farm and her peacocks that she loved and all this kind of stuff that she had on her farm with her. And then I have a book called Understanding Flannery O'Connor. Which is kind of helpful for pointing out big themes, and for me, because I'm just not trained to read things this way.
Yeah.
And one thing I did want to read just before starting off, let's see if I can find it, where she's talking about somebody, she had, for a short time, she had letters going back and forth to a professor of English who was asking questions about her interpretations. And after talking a little bit about A Good Man is Hard to Find, she says, the meaning of a story should go on expanding for the reader the more he thinks about it, but meaning cannot be captured in an interpretation. If teachers are in the habit of approaching a story as if it were a research problem for which any answer is believable so long as it is not obvious, then I think students will never learn to enjoy fiction. Too much interpretation is certainly worse than too little, and where feeling for a story is absent, theory will not supply it. My tone is not meant to be obnoxious. I'm in a state of shock, which you mentioned that before.
Yeah,
and that's,
I love that line.
Yeah, it's about reading the interpretation of her 90 students and three teachers and saying how far it was from what she intended. And this is when she's going, this character's only importance was to drive the car. That's it.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Yeah, I've been in things with science fiction writers before where they've, you know, lamented kind of what she's saying, you know, by, you know, this whole theory of literature where you're in there and you're trying to pick everything apart and everything's a symbol and all this stuff does kind of dull people's enthusiasm for fiction. And, you know, but that's what's taught in colleges and high schools and that. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, it's interesting to see her say that, you know, and she's one of the people who I think, you know, that I've read that have a lot to interpret, you know, when I think of Flannery O'Connor, I think of her as a realist writer, you know, and to me, what realism is that you are writing kind of about the real world, quote unquote, and everything that you include in your story has to be kind of from observation. It can't be, you're not going to see like a ghost or a, you know what I mean? You're not going to see the supernatural in her story. But at the same time, what she has is, it's almost she's saying, okay, this is a layer that you're looking at, and there's something beyond this layer that is supernatural going on.
Yeah, and she would say a lot of times that she's not a realist the way that most people think of realism writing. She, this made me think, and I'm like, I've got all these post-its everywhere from her comments, but one of the things that she said was that for her, the term Christian realism is necessary. She goes, perhaps in a purely academic way, because I find myself in a world where everybody has his compartment, puts you in yours, shuts the door, and departs. And you read this and you go, wow, that's still so true now, and that was written in 1955. One of the awful things about writing when you're a Christian is that for you, the ultimate reality is the incarnation. The present reality is the incarnation, and nobody believes in the incarnation. That is, nobody is your audience. My audience are the people who think God is dead. At least these are the people I am conscious of writing for. As for Jesus, Jesus is being a realist. If he was not God, he was no realist, only a liar, and the crucifixion an act of justice. And to me, because I remember somewhere else she said, I'm not a realist, like I said, the way that a lot of people like to think of it. And I think it's because it's what you said, is she takes things you can see, but what she does with them can be so shocking.
Yeah.
And it's that, and I guess in a second, if we start talking about the stories, people who haven't read them, we'll see what we mean. But I was thinking about when we were picking stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked The River because I hadn't read it before you said, let's read this book.
Mm-hmm.
I had just read a few stories that somebody else had picked out for the book club. And there was something about The River that I really liked, and it drew me to it. But if you'd have asked me why, I wouldn't have been able to say. And, you know, a child drowns himself at the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
And... but it's with, I don't know, and I guess when we talk about it, we can talk about what that actually is saying to us, but I went and reread it two more times and just kept going, this story calls me to it in some way, and that's what you're talking about. It's that it's using real things, but she's looking below the surface.
Yeah, but she's looking past the realist surface, so... for me, the first story I read of hers was A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
That'll shock you.
Yeah, and I read that, and I was stunned at the end of that. Just completely floored by it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, I mean, I sat there and I thought about it, and I was really amazed with what the story said to me. But at the same time, it was almost... for me to put in words what the story said to me was very, very difficult. So
right.
I read it again, you know, and I'm like, what? And, you know, so when you're saying to me, you know, what happened in this story, I felt exactly the same way, but it touched me in a very deep way. So, you know, I read it again, trying to find out exactly, well, what exactly did that say? And
what does it call forth from within?
What does it call forth from within? Yeah. And I guess this is what the word ineffable is for.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's, so, yeah.
It's a very kind of, it's kind of a delicate thing, but it leaves you thinking about it.
Yeah.
For some time. And yet at the same time, really quickly, I just want to say, these stories can be hilarious.
They can be, yeah.
And there's a recording, and we can put a link, of her reading A Good Man is Hard to Find. And the first thing I'm so stunned at is her accent.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same, I think, is it at the same place? She has a like a 8 or 9 minute introduction to her reading of it that talks about the use of the grotesque in Southern literature.
Hmm. Boy, that wasn't in the one that I heard.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was a separate recording. And okay. You can tell she starts to read it and they kind of cut it off and made it two things. I'll have to send you the link.
Okay. Yeah, please do.
And I should have listened to it another time or two, but I didn't have time. But it's just interesting to see how thoughtful she really is about it.
Yeah. And when she says grotesque, what exactly do you mean by that? Something that's
shocking and alarming.
Shocking and alarming. Okay.
And kind of twisted, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and those things are in these stories. I mean, it's just like, you know, almost like a gunshot. You can hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially A Good Man is Hard to Find is one of her most shocking. And I felt really awful because I knew Flannery O'Connor's reputation and I'd read a couple of her stories. And then I had said, oh, look, everybody, A Good Man's Hard to Find. Here's Flannery O'Connor reading it. And one of my good friends listened to it. And she'd never experienced any Flannery O'Connor and just knew she was a Catholic story author.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, why did you have me listen to that? That was the most horrible story ever. I was in the grocery store just wanting to cry.
Oh.
I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. But at the same time, when Flannery's reading that story, she is stopping and laughing at some of the stuff in it. And the audience is laughing. And when we did the book club, things that I read to myself and went, huh, we were reading them out loud to each other, and then we couldn't stop laughing because they were so funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the horrible parts, but the other parts. I mean, the parts that, of life that she surrounds it with are just hilarious.
Yeah, they are. They are. Especially Good Country People, in my opinion, of the three we're going to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, talk about skewering pretension.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and she does some of that in A Good Man is Hard to Find, too. Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of it, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So a good man is hard to find starts out, the first sentence is, the grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. She wanted to visit some of her connections in East Tennessee, and she was seizing at every chance to change Bailey's mind. Bailey was a son she lived with, her only boy. I'm just going to read the entire story.
Yeah, hold on. Please do. It's so beautifully written.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, I guess we should mention that Flannery O'Connor is Southern. I mean, you mentioned her accent, and that's that's
Georgia?
Important. You know, some of my favorite writers are Southern. Pat Conroy, who we haven't talked about, but maybe someday will.
Mm-hmm.
And remember Alden Bell? I don't know if he's Southern, but remember that was Southern Gothic, and
it sure was.
Description on the front that caught you was, this is, what was it exactly?
O'Connor. Yeah, Flannery O'Connor, but with zombies.
But with zombies or something like that, yeah. This whole Southern style. Really love it. The story is about this grandmother and her family that's around her are going on a trip. And right here on this very, in the very beginning, they're reading the newspapers. And they start to talk about this fellow called the Misfit, who is an escaped convict, right?
The grandmother keeps bringing him up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she...
He's a killer.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see, yes. And what would you do if this fellow, the Misfit, caught you, the grandmother asked. I'd smack his face, John Wesley said. She wouldn't stay at home for $1 million, June Starr said, afraid she'd miss something. They're just talking about the Misfit, and she's, you know, the grandmother, I think, is the key to me. The grandmother was the key character in this story.
Oh, yeah.
she was the one, you know, she's Christian and somewhat hypocritical, I think, or somewhat high and mighty. She's, you know, passing judgment on people, you know, and, all the time.
And she wants things done the way she wants them done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does. She does.
She wants to control everyone.
In case of accident, anyone seeing her dead on the highway would know at once that she was a lady.
Right. Right.
That is one heck of a good sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so they pile up in their car, you know, she's a lady. They go driving. They end up going on this dirt road. They roll the car. And along comes who but the Misfit and a couple of his henchmen.
And the whole reason they're even on this side road is because the grandmother is trying to divert them. She thinks she remembers some plantation, and she makes up a story of a secret panel because she wants to take this little side trip. And then as they're turning down this road, she says, oh, wait, I think I remember that was in Tennessee. And so, but she's not going to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, and then she insists on bringing her cat, and the cat gets out and jumps on her son who's driving the car, and the car rolls. So everything that happens
mm-hmm.
is because she's essentially lying or doing things just to suit herself.
Right.
Which I think is key to the story.
Mm-hmm. I think it is, too. I think it is, too.
Way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Misfit comes.
And then the Misfit comes with their, you know, his two
henchmen.
Yeah. And one of them, Red Sammy, says, a good man is hard to find. Everything's getting terrible. I remember the day you could go off and leave your screen door unlatched. Not no more. Yeah.
Well, that's on the way. That's
on the way. I'm sorry.
Lunch.
That's right.
And that does start that conversation because they have this little conversation about that kind of thing.
I'm sorry. I apologize. That's right. I'm just kind of flipping through my highlights here.
Yeah, it kind of sets the story of what is a good man and what does it mean when you say that, because everything the grandmother's concerned with is very surface oriented, very superficial,
and you know she's you know made that story up like you said, and she's you know making herself up as this Christian woman, and yet she's manipulating. She's, you know, very high and mighty, like I said, all throughout this, you know, and she's putting herself off as, you know, she's the superior good one here. And
she's the one who recognizes the Misfit, and he says, well, it would have been better if you hadn't recognized me.
That's right. That's right.
So she's the instigator of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She's the reason they're on the road. I mean, she's the reason for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
you wouldn't shoot a lady, would you?
Yeah. She says that several times, which gets into the shocking stuff. I mean, it took me on the first read. You know, I'm listening to this, and they're like,
stunning.
They're taking these guys into the woods, and I'm like, what are they going to do in the woods?
Yeah,
and then, but the Flannery O'Connor keeps the scene with the grandmother, who is at the car with the Misfit, and it's an incredible conversation between the Misfit and the grandmother. And then you hear two gunshots in the woods.
Yeah. They've taken the father and the little boy off. And that was what got me was first of all, they didn't really need to do that. But second of all, it's the children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And the whole time she starts babbling faster and faster and faster, trying to appeal to some part of him that they could connect with. You know, I just know you're a good man, she said desperately. You're not a bit common.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
And,
as if that is what the determining factor would be.
Right. And she's talking on a surface level, but when he answers her, he's answering from a deeper, more real level, a more sincere level.
Mm-hmm.
He says, no, I ain't a good man, the Misfit said after a second, as if he had considered her statement carefully. But I ain't the worst in the world, neither. My daddy said I was a different breed of dog from my brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. You know, Daddy said, it's some that can live their whole life out without asking about it, and it's others has to know why it is, and this boy is one of the latter. He's going to be into everything. And that's him. He's not in a good way, but always looking deeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I found out the crime don't matter. You can do one thing or you can do another. Kill a man or take a tire off his car, because sooner or later, you're going to forget what it was you done and just be punished for it. It's another thing that he keeps talking about is he doesn't believe that his punishment has matched what he's done. And that affects his character. He ends up doing worse and worse things because of that.
I guess that's okay. I never caught that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And at least that's my feeling.
No, I
and then,
believe you.
and I love this part. You know, the misfit is the one that's talking about Jesus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This paragraph too, you know, Jesus was the only one that ever raised the dead, the misfit continued, and he shouldn't have done it. He thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but throw away everything and follow him. And if he didn't, then it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few minutes you got left the best way you can, by killing somebody or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. No pleasure but meanness, he said, and his voice had become almost a snarl. Maybe he didn't raise the dead, the old lady mumbled, not knowing what she was saying and feeling so dizzy that she sank down in the ditch with her legs twisted under her. I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the misfit said. I wished I'd have been there. Yeah. You know, and I read that and I'm like, wow, okay. You know?
Yeah, because what happens is each of these characters that she's looking at will have their moment of grace in these
right.
stories.
Yep.
And they usually come after something really shocking, that, and it's to make you pay attention. And she will point out that that's what happens, you know, when God's dealing with you. A lot of times you have to be shocked so you pay attention.
Right, right.
And when you have that moment of grace, nobody else around you may understand it, but it touches you and it's meant for you, and you suddenly see something nobody else does.
Right, yeah.
And so at this point, because the grandmother, now the mother and the little girl have been taken off into the woods, and you hear the pistol shots. And,
yeah,
because he says, when he goes on saying, I wasn't there to say if he didn't, he said, I wish I had been there. He said, hitting the ground with his fist, it ain't right I wasn't there, because if I had been there, I would have known. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice, if I had been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now. His voice seemed to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. See, that's clearing from what she's going through, but it's also clearing from her entire life.
Yeah.
And she says she saw the man's face twisted close to her own as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children. She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her three times through the chest. Then he put his gun down on the ground and took off his glasses and began to clean them. And that's when you're just like, what did I just read?
Yeah. It's just like, what in the heck? And then the line that blows everybody away. She would have been a good woman, the misfit said, if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life.
Some fun, Bobby Lee said. Shut up, Bobby Lee, the misfit said. It's no real pleasure in life.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been talking about that's all you can do is be mean because it's fun, because there's no meaning in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that moment, because she describes the grandmother lying there smiling up at the sky, and they each had an epiphany at that point.
Yeah.
Of course, the reader's so shocked, you've got to read it several times at that point to get it. But it's. It sets everything off balance. It brings the world into focus for the grandmother for a moment.
For a moment,
because
right.
she's relating to the misfit is, you know, when she says, you're one of my own children, she's relating to him on a level beyond what she's been afraid of the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that thing about the misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her three times through the chest. And you think of... the snake in the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but also at the same time, the three times I was reading something, it was saying it's like Peter denying Jesus three times. So there's that connection with what are you betraying and what are you accepting? I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, it does. It does.
I did when I was reading and thinking about it last night. I kept wanting to say, Tom, listen to this, but he hadn't read the story.
Yeah. So. Again, it's it affects me in a way that I can't quite touch. I think about it and it means a great deal. And, you know, it does, this reading this story for the first time did change me a little bit. It's one of those kinds of stories where, you know, it touched me on such a deep level that, you know, it did affect me. And then, you know, reading it again and again, you know, so now I've read it, what, three or four times, you know, you pick up a few little things too, but still, I mean, it's still impactful. And, you know, why do we need these shocks to shake us out of, you know, the way we are and see clearly? That's the kind of things I think about after reading this story. But it is quite shocking.
Well, it is. And even when you're rereading it, for this is my third or fourth time of reading this story. And one thing it did, though, is it kind of made me less afraid of reading stories that have stuff like this in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not done just for shock value. And I think of, you know, people protest the violence in this story, but at least it's written to mean something and to touch us on a deeper level. And think of the violence that we see on TV or in the movies or read about in a book every day that are for nothing more than to move a story along.
That's an excellent point. You know, and watch Castle or something and, you know, somebody gets murdered in that show every week. And it means nothing. Yeah, and sometimes in terrible ways, and it means nothing. Yet I read this story, and the violence occurs, and it's shocking. And I guess it's a good thing to know that I could still be shocked by that, you know, with the television that I've watched. So this story touches you in a different way. This is not, it's not like, you know, watching TV.
Well,
you know, and that's an interesting thought because, you know, why is it that way?
Well, I'm just thinking, and because you know what it is? We're used to stories that play fair. Nobody would take the father and the son off and just shoot them. And the mother and the little girl are left and everybody's listening. You know what those shots mean. And then they come off and take the other two off. And there's no reason for it, really. They're in an isolated place. They couldn't tell anybody about it for a long time. Those people could have gotten away. They had a car that worked and the other people didn't. It's being mean for pleasure.
Yeah.
Not caring at all. And in Castle, do you think they would do that? Oh, here's a whole family that was killed for no particular reason at all. They rarely do something like that. There's always a motive because we want a motive. And so
yeah, you're true. That's what those whole stories are about. Figuring out why
playing fair in that way of thinking. But yet she's being really fair because what she's doing is fraught with meaning and she uses every word so carefully.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a remarkable story.
Write them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the thing about the snake. This is what I was looking at. Let's see. And even these things, these are fairly short little summaries, so they can't really take it apart for us, which is fine because this is from that Understanding Flannery O'Connor, which just kind of helps point me down the right road of thinking about it. It says, instantly upon hearing her words, the misfit, as if a snake had bitten him, shoots her three times. In this sentence, O'Connor couples a reference to a snake fraught with links to the devil from the biblical Garden of Eden with three, a number that O'Connor repeatedly uses to elicit the Christian Trinity. In an allegorical reading, the devil is destroyed by Christ's goodness. However, the snake is associated with the grandmother, ungrasping yet innocent, and the three with the misfit, full of meanness. The misfit's words are a reminder as well of Christ's words to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," which suggests that one has seen the truth, who has seen the truth, can also be poisoned by the devil's venom and betray that truth. because the misfit struggles with the Jesus question and because the grandmother acknowledges a bond with the misfit, both characters demonstrate that good that is so hard to find.
Well, that's interesting.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have any key like that at all, if you don't start reading her stories when, and I know she doesn't want you to deconstruct them, but you have to read them with a sense of awareness and alertness. If you're not reading her stories like that and noticing, well, there's two birds in the sky. Well, that's a different story. But there's, you know, these things happening, and she keeps mentioning three and three, and this thing is done three times, and these things are balanced against each other, then you're not going to have any clues, and you're going to be like me or my poor friend who listened to the story going, what the what, and why did this story even get written?
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
But
yeah, what a story. Yeah, but that, I'm just sitting here thinking about what you just read. That's it. That's really interesting. And, you know, you never know. Well, you know, we have those letters of hers. You know, do you think she meant all that? You know, that's always a question, isn't it? You know, does an author mean all that stuff? But I remember in talking to Eric Rabkin one time, he was saying, well, that's kind of an irrelevant question because, you know, these stories come from, well, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but what I understood, you know, another view of it is, well, one, you know, the author did not mean that, but the other side is, well, it's irrelevant if the author meant it or not because it's there.
And, right. It's what you take away from
it. It's what you take away from it, right. Exactly.
Well, I know in her letter, the only thing, this is the letter where I had said the meaning of a story should go on expanding. Right before it, after she said, I am totally shocked, as you know, all these interpretations. And she says, that those interpretations were so far away. And she said, if it were a legitimate interpretation, the story would be little more than a trick and its interest would simply be for abnormal psychology. I am not interested in abnormal psychology. There is a change of tension from the first part of the story to the second where the misfit enters, but this is no lessening of reality. This story is, of course, not meant to be realistic in the sense that it portrays the everyday doings of people in Georgia. It is stylized and its conventions are comic, even though its meaning is serious. Then she says, it is the grandmother who first recognizes the misfit and who is most concerned with him throughout. The story is a duel of sorts between the grandmother and her superficial beliefs and the misfit's more profoundly felt involvement with Christ's action, which set the world off balance for him. And that's all she says about it. And so everything she does is clearly designed at pointing us in that direction. And so I don't think you're reading too much into it if you see those things that interpretation I read said. Because she's trying to look here, look, this is what I'm saying. And she's writing from that worldview of a Catholic Christian.
Right.
But as she was saying, you know, it doesn't matter if his hat is black and the sun is only there to drive the car. He has no other significance. This point of the story is this.
Yeah. Yeah, I often think that, you know, people think that, you know, I doubt even Flannery O'Connor sat down and figured out, okay, if I do this and if I do this and, you know, I put this in there and I put that in there and this is going to be my theme and I'm going to write this story. I think that she, you know, from what you read, what I get is that she had the idea of the grandmother's character and the misfit's character and what drives them both. And then she wrote what you call this duel between them, and the themes emerge from that. I think that they occurred, you know?
I would say from what I remember of her talking about writing, because there is somebody who she corresponds with regularly who's writing, and she gives them a lot of her point of view of just, you know, well, in general, remember to do this. And she, at one point, said there is a story, and I can't remember the name of it, where a woman gets gored by a bull in the end. And I remember her saying, I'm wrestling with a story right now, and the one thing I know is that I want that bull's horns winding up in this woman's chest. I'm not sure about a lot of the rest of it. And then when she gives advice about writing, she'll say, just pick out the same time every day and sit there with no phone, And she had her desk against a white wall with no pictures. She wrote with a typewriter, but she's like, write however it is that you want to write, by hand or whatever. She goes, and if you do nothing for that 3 hours but wrestle with writing a few sentences, your job is done. And she goes, you may write something that matters. You may not. You may not be able to tell till later, but that's your job. And so I would say that between all those kinds of things is what you said is right, is she'll say, here's my idea. And I know there's another story about, what's it, the chill, or, but it's about the Holy Ghost, basically, which mm-hmm. we, these days we would call it the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And she's sending a letter, the enduring chill. And she sends somebody a letter. She says, well, the one thing I know is this is making me laugh. The Holy Spirit is going to be a water stain in the ceiling. And sure enough, this guy thinks he's sick. And so he's lying in bed and there's a water stain that looks like this and looks like that. And eventually it comes down at the end of the story and kind of consumes him.
Wow.
And that's her, you know, so I think she was, but she, I know she wrote and rewrote stories and threw stories away all the time. And so some of it was definitely deliberate craft, and some of it is, well, you've written.
Mm-hmm.
And I have dabbled in fiction, although, and I should get back to it, I'm told, but nothing that anybody's really ever seen. But it's the kind of thing where if you just sit and start writing, you can be surprised at where it takes you.
Yeah. Without
whether it's got meaning or not.
And so I don't think you can sit down and try to create a meaningful story. Because if you do that, if that's your purpose, if that's what you, mm-hmm. you're trying to do, you're saying, I'm going to write a story and the theme is going to be this, and mm-hmm. you write it, I think that it'll be dissatisfying to read. I think that themes emerge from your writing naturally.
From the writing the story, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And then you may see what's there.
Mm-hmm.
And like, isn't it Tolkien who, when he was rereading The Lord of the Rings or whatever he'd written so far, he went, wow, look at all this Catholic stuff in here. I'm going to just touch it. I'm going to punch it up a little.
I think Tolkien actually said something like, you know, he didn't like people trying to put stuff in there. You know, he was not for interpretation of his story as something past myth.
Right. Yeah. But that's why he and C.S. Lewis would read each other, you know, they'd read each other's stories when the mm-hmm. Inklings, their little group of friends, would get together in that pub.
Yeah, yeah.
And they kind of despised the way each other told stories. And I have to say, I've read 4 of the 7 Narnia books.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, it's fine and all. And for kids, it's fine. But, you know, once you get to be a little older, you're like, whoa, this is just so obvious. I can't stand it. And that's more of what you're talking about, which is kind of funny because C.S. Lewis wrote things on so many different levels. We may someday read Till They Have Faces, which is a retelling of Cupid and Psyche, but it has been, like, in a way, Flannery O'Connorized. And it's not at all like the Narnia stories. It's really amazing.
Oh, good.
And
I have not read that one. So.
Yeah, it sends your mind goggling because you just go, I need to read this several more times before I really even understand why it's so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that same thing that she's doing here. They're letting the story take them, and who they are and what they believe and what they know is informing it. And of course, since they're writers who have craft, they're going through again, I'm sure, and going, oh, you know, this versus this, this versus that. But a lot of it's just coming from what have they read? What do they internalize? That's mm-hmm. like reading older writers who, what is it I've heard lately of? I read something recently, now I can't remember, but they'll talk about people who were really steeped in the King James version of the Bible or in Shakespeare. The way they write and express themselves takes on some of those richer cadences and expressions because that's informing what they know.
Yeah.
And therefore it's deeper and richer through their craft.
Yeah, and there's something about the Southern writer that I mentioned earlier. You know, Flannery O'Connor's beautiful, and Pat Conroy is as well. You know, that's just two examples, but something going on down there in the South.
Yeah, I guess.
Sure what.
Yeah, because when we get to Good Country People, I'm going to insist on reading the first three or first paragraph, which I read it four times before I went on to read the rest of the story.
Oh,
for
that's
some reason,
cool.
It just hit me.
That's excellent. All right, yeah, we better move on. We're going to run out of time.
Oh my gosh.
So let's talk.
Okay.
Let's talk quickly about the river. He ain't fixed right, a loud voice said from the hall. Well, then, for Christ's sake, fix him, the father muttered. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. That's just at the very beginning of the river.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He was in his bathroom and barefooted.
Mm-hmm.
When he got the child to the door and tried to shut it, he found her looming in it, a speckled skeleton in a long pea-green coat and felt helmet. I love the fact these people are so real.
Yeah.
You know, the way they talk, the way they're dressed, you can really see this pale little kid who's not even dressed right. His right arm was hung in the sleeve, but the father buttoned the coat anyway and pushed him forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way the whole story begins, there's this little boy who is not properly taken care of.
Yeah.
You get that feel.
Mm-hmm.
And they need a babysitter, so this lady is going to take, I don't remember how they know her even.
Yeah, I don't recall that either.
Mm-hmm. Going to, she may never say, but they're going to take her, she's going to take the little boy to her house. And she says, oh, well, we're going to the river to a healing maybe later. This particular preacher don't get around this way often. So that's the only thing you know. And his mom is sick. That's why he's got to be watched after for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they get on the bus, I guess, and they go to her house. The problem is if you tell this without the details, you feel like you're missing most of the story.
Yeah, for certain.
But they get to the house, and what you find is that the little boy doesn't understand how things really are at all.
Yeah.
No one's ever given him a handkerchief. She gives him a handkerchief because his nose is running, and he looks at it very carefully and puts it carefully in a coat pocket.
Mm-hmm.
The little kids at her house, I guess her children, I loved this. There's something behind a fence. And he doesn't know what it is, and they say, oh, it's pigs. Come over here and look. And he says, what is it? He says, well, he knew what pigs were. They were pink and had curly tails and little bow ties. So he looks through the board, and it says, another face, gray, wet, and sour, was pushing into his, knocking him down and back as it scraped out under the plank. Something snorted over him and charged back again, rolling him over and pushing him up from behind and then sending him forward screaming through the yellow field while it bounded behind. And it's a real pig. It's a shote, which I think is a young pig. And he was long-legged and humpbacked, and part of one of his ears had been bitten off. And Bevel screams for 5 minutes, even sitting on her lap. Oh, Bevel, the little kid, his name is not Bevel, but he hears that the preacher's name is Bevel, and the lady's talking to him, and she goes, well, and he goes, my name's Bevel, and she goes, really? That's what a coincidence. And so he renames himself, which is always important. And after this preacher, who he's never, he doesn't even understand what that is.
Yeah.
And,
Here's a little thing. It occurred to him that he was lucky this time that they had found Mrs. Conan, who would take you away for a day instead of an ordinary sitter who only sat where you lived or went to the park. You found out more when you left where you lived. He had found out already this morning that he had been made by a carpenter named Jesus Christ.
I love that.
Yeah. Before that, he thought it was a doctor named Sladewell, a fat man with a yellow mustache who gave him shots and thought his name was Herbert, but this must have been a joke. They joked a lot where he lived. If he thought about it before, he would have thought Jesus Christ was a word like oh or damn or God, or maybe somebody who had cheated them out of something sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was...
Since when he had asked Mrs. Conan who the man in the sheet in the picture over her bed was, she had looked at him a while with her mouth open.
Mm-hmm.
Then she had said, that's Jesus. And she had kept on looking at him. And then she gets out a book that's like Bible stories for children. Here, I think you should look at this. But you notice that what the book, he says, he's It was full of pictures. One of the carpenter driving a crowd of pigs out of a man. Mm-hmm. They were real pigs, gray and sour looking. And so, so the book is telling him what's real.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I loved that whole bit because it tells you so much about the very sophisticated atmosphere of, they joked a lot where he lived. So the little kid doesn't know what to take seriously and he doesn't know what's real and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you agree with Mrs. Conan that, you know, it's, you know, that's Jesus. And because all the pictures at her house are of real things.
Mm-hmm.
And she comments early on the pictures in the apartment that they're abstract pictures. She's like, I could have painted that better myself.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
She did say that.
Really,
yeah. I wouldn't have bought that. I'd have painted that myself.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's contrasting the two worlds, and he's never seen this other world where people think differently. And then they go down to the river where the preacher heals people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because there's all these people there going, you healed me. Well, I seen you cure a woman once. I seen that woman get up and walk out straight where she limped in.
Yeah.
And the preacher keeps going, you might as well go home if that's what you came for. Says, listen to what I got to say, you people. There ain't but one river, and that's the river of life, made out of Jesus's blood. That's the river you have to lay your pain in, and the river of faith, and the river of life, and the river of love, and the rich red river of Jesus's blood, you people.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Right.
Yep.
So he's constantly rejecting the need for healing.
Yep.
And then they find out the little boy hasn't been baptized. Well, that's got to be taken care of.
Yep.
When at one point he says, believe in Jesus or the devil, testify to one or the other. And to me, that was a real key to the story of, you know, the two worlds. The two things that this little boy knows, the way that she's telling the story. Because the testimony that this preacher gives is almost embarrassing to me as a Catholic.
Yeah.
And as somebody who didn't stop off in that level of the Protestant world first, you know. It's, you know, the river is to lay your pain down in, to get rid of your sin in, to get rid of suffering, to, you know, all those things. It's all those stereotypes, which are kind of funny to hear, but yet true at the same time.
Hmm.
I don't know if this makes sense to you.
No, it does make sense to me. Yeah. It's almost as if all the emphases are different, you know? And then that is another interesting thing about Flannery O'Connor. I've heard her described as she's a Catholic, but she lives in the evangelical world, you know, so she's surrounded by evangelicals in the South. I just think that that's an interesting juxtaposition too. And I think we see that in this story. So it's just the preacher is evangelical. He's not a Catholic in any way.
And
emphases are different. You know, what they, you know, some of it, in my opinion, is incorrect, but at the same time, a lot of it is correct, but emphasized, you know, that this is the point of this. This is the point of that. This is the point of that. And you're like, well, I don't think that is the point of that. But,
she was definitely Catholic.
Yeah.
No matter what.
No question.
She might have not agreed with something that somebody in the church might do, but she definitely, all through her letters, is constantly defending the church itself.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of the things in the church, like I say, she might not agree with. And I was trying to think, I don't know if I marked it, somewhere she talks about Southern Protestants who she lives among and the differences and the good and the bad. And I may not have marked it, though. It doesn't matter that much. But it's kind of funny because basically the things she's talking about and that baptism is real. It's a real sacrament.
Mm-hmm.
It really changes you.
Yeah.
That's the center of the story because the little boy gets baptized. And it's funny because he started, my name is Bevel, he said in a loud, deep voice. And he's mocking the preacher. And nobody laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And it says the grin had already disappeared from his face. He had the sudden feeling that this was not a joke, Where he lived, everything was a joke. From the preacher's face, he knew immediately that nothing the preacher said or did was a joke. And he's only 4 or 5, so of course any kid that age has a hard time with what's real and what's not real.
Yeah.
But I just think it's interesting how she, because I kind of was raised in the same environment. You're kind of scornful of people like this preacher. We had more modern paintings. I mean, I really, you know, the things like this woman, Mrs. Conan, had on her wall, my family would have laughed at equally.
Hmm.
You know, and so I can really kind of relate to the little kid and some of his bewilderment with what am I seeing? And yet at the same time, having read these letters, I still remember, I wonder if Flannery O'Connor's kind of poking fun even at herself, because she came back one time from, she and her mother, they would go to daily mass when they could. And she goes, you know, the priest had decorated the church for St. Patrick's Day. And she's like, my mother and I just looked at each other and didn't even dare roll our eyes because it was all, you know, four-leaf clovers. And she was like the most, sounded like the most, like, schoolroom type of decorations. And she was like, we were just like, oh, we'll just suffer through this, too.
Oh, man. Yep.
So she recognizes the type because she's part of that type who would laugh at that stuff too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. Okay. So he's being baptized.
Yeah, yeah. And this was key also.
Right.
You won't be the same again. The preacher said, you'll count.
That's it. Yep. Cause he wants to count, this kid. This kid wants to count.
Don't we all?
So the preacher says that and yep, I'm in. I want to do that now. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And he says, I won't go back to the apartment again, but then I'll go under the river.
Mm-hmm. You count now. You didn't even count before. The little boy was too shocked to cry. He spit out the muddy water and rubbed his wet sleeve into his eyes and over his face. Yeah.
And then the babysitter says, well, don't forget his mama. She's sick. And the little kid says, well, she hasn't got up yet. She's got a hangover. And everybody suddenly goes, what? That's not being sick. And so reality suddenly splinters everything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It says the air was so quiet, he could hear the broken pieces of the sun knocking the water. Those two worlds clash together.
Mm-hmm.
And reality hits that world, too, that he's from. Because then they take him back.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents are awake, and like the mother's like, what did you do? And they find out the little boy's name isn't Bevel, it's Harry. The mother's lying on the couch, and it's clear that they're hard partiers and high livers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the little boy gets up the next morning, and he's searching around the apartment for something to eat. He's, because his parents are asleep, he goes, well, I guess they'll sleep till about 1 or so. Maybe we'll go to the restaurant for lunch. So you see the kind of life he lives. He's neglected in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, very slowly his expression changed as if he were gradually seeing appear what he didn't know he'd been looking for. Then all of a sudden, he knew what he wanted to do. And he goes and takes either a token or so. He takes a car token, some lifesavers, supplies for the trip. And he goes down to the trolley car or the bus or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he goes back to the river.
Yeah. Yes, he does. And he gets in the river because he wants to baptize himself again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is... He intended not to fool with preachers anymore, but to baptize with a capital B himself and keep on going this time until he found the kingdom of Christ in the river. He didn't mean to waste any more time.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's thinking he needs to go under the river. Things weren't different. Although when his mother says, what did you do? And she just wants to know, what were they saying about me? He just says, I count now.
Yeah.
So he's grasped the heart of what it means to encounter Christ. I count now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Because we all count equally, and after that encounter, you're not the same. You're different somehow.
Yeah, this is a tough story. I mean, not that the last one wasn't, but so he gets in that river, and he keeps trying to go under to find the kingdom of Christ, but the river seems to be rejecting him. And then he says, oh, this is all a joke too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was tough.
Mm-hmm.
And then the river takes him. And that's tough too.
Well, it's funny because I had always avoided this story because I'd heard, mm-hmm. I had heard the spoiler that the kid drowns at the end, and I thought it was an accidental drowning or someone killed him. And I read this, and when you read the reason he's doing it,
mm-hmm.
it didn't to me feel like he died. Even yeah. though Mr. Paradise is there and he's trying to save him, although we didn't talk about him, and her names do mean things. It says he plunged, it says he heard a shout and turned his head and saw something like a giant pig bounding after him, shaking a red and white club and shouting. And that's Mr. Paradise, who's like, oh, he's trying to save him.
Mm-hmm.
He plunged under once, and this time the waiting current caught him like a long, gentle hand and pulled him swiftly forward and down. For an instant, he was overcome with surprise. Then, since he was moving quickly and knew that he was getting somewhere, all his fury and fear left him. Mr. Paradise's head appeared from time to time on the surface of the water. Finally, far downstream, the old man rose like some ancient water monster and stood empty-handed, staring with his dull eyes as far down the river line as he could see. And I look at that and I think of how Mr. Paradise is constantly mentioned in connection with that pig, because both of them have a partial ear,
mm-hmm.
kind of gray like that. And we also see those same pigs described in the book where, you know, Jesus is driving the pigs out of the man, but really we know that Jesus drove the legion of demons out of the man, and the pigs went over, they took the pigs over the cliff. So anybody who has the most elemental understanding of those pigs and looks at this story, to me it wasn't tough. To me I was like, wow, he was determined and he found it and nothing could stop him. He couldn't, the demons couldn't get him, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's why, to me, it was even really almost a gentle story at the end. I guess because it's told from his perspective.
Yeah.
Because now he counts.
Now he counts.
I don't think of him drowning, even though obviously he did, but it's not described in terms of from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, the tough thing for me is that, he counted before, It's, my pain in this story is, he didn't know, and it's like he was misunderstanding everything, the entire story, and I felt like he misunderstood at the end too. But at the same time, when in that last paragraph, as you read it, the reality is he's drowning, but his perception of the drowning, his own perception of the drowning, is that he's going somewhere. And I do believe that he is headed somewhere, which, that colors it too, but still, it's...
Well, I know, but see, I never thought of the river. I guess it's real. This one I read really in the way when she said, this isn't intended to be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this was not really realistic. And so when I looked at it, I was like, I know that little boy in himself counted before, but everything was a joke. His life had never meant anything because his parents didn't act as if he counted. They don't mm-hmm. beat him. His father doesn't even bother to make sure he has his coat on straight. The first time he's anywhere where anybody acts like he's real and things aren't a joke and so they matter is with Mrs. Conan and the preacher.
Yeah.
And when he keeps talking about the river, the river, the river, this is what the river is. And, I'm sure it's one of those rivers where if you've seen that Georgia dirt, or Oklahoma has the same kind of dirt. It's this red dirt full of iron.
Sure.
So any muddy river is going to look like that river of blood. But at the same time, would there have been all those descriptions of that river and what it does for you? And in a sense, I guess this is the one where maybe she'd go, girl, you're reading too much into it. But I looked at it and I went, you know what? It looks stupid from the outside because we say everything's a joke. But when you've been dipped in that river and you really accept that a lot of it is what he's saying, it's a real sacrament. It really changes you. You can't see it on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
You're still stuck in the apartment.
And you really do die in a way. You know, I've seen that in so many people.
Right.
Where, you know, and that's a difficulty a lot of people have with accepting religion is they're viewing it as, well, I'm comfortable here and I've got my friends here and they're not coming with me. So right. if they decide to go ahead and make that change, they're dying to themselves and are reborn. Because their life is new. And if their friends don't come with them, you have to make that decision to let that go. So in a way, you do die.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard. Yeah. Well, it's like Mr. Paradise in a way, I guess. There's somebody bounding after you, trying to stop you.
Yeah.
And meaning it for the best.
Right.
But not getting it. And it's funny when you said that because dying to yourself, there's a song... I don't remember what it's called now, but by the Stained is the group. And it's evidently the guy went through the main singer, who's also the main songwriter for them. He went through an epiphany after his child was born, which happens to so many of us because suddenly it's not a joke. This helps another focus to help us see life as real when you have children, as we both know.
Yeah.
But the whole song is about, I can't believe that my life is what it is now. I don't mind it. I'm so happy, and I can't believe I'm living this life that I would have laughed at before. I'll have to find it because it's really, I'm not saying it right. And normally I could just sing those songs then because that's my life too. I look at my life now and I look at the things that I'll agree to and say or say are wrong. And I know myself from 12, 15 years ago would have come, what an idiot, what a sap. But that part of me, I see it differently. I see what's real. But I understand how people don't see it. I mean, which is why on Goodreads, there's this person who at one point he said, he'd said, this is the third book I've read to try to understand Christianity. And I was like, oh, really? Well, then if that's the case, here's this one thing that you're struggling with in what this person described, and I'm going to tell you what the Catholics would say about it, good and evil and this kind of thing. And I won't take you through the whole thing, but we had quite a long conversation where what happened is he started shifting ground and shifting ground and shifting ground. I went, oh, you're not necessarily so interested in finding out what Christians would really say as you are in defending what you already think. Got it. But I kept coming back to him reading other books, and I finally said, have you gone back to the source materials? Have you read the Gospels just to read them and think about them? And he says, I have, but I need someone to explain them to me. And he said, I don't understand being saved. I don't understand what's the point. And I was like, oh, I wish you hadn't said this. Because now I know what's the point. And I'm going to have to tell you what's the point. And I'm going to have to say it in an unmistakable way that's going to sound just like that preacher in the river.
Yep.
Here's the point. Christ came into the world to get in between us and everything that makes us unhappy and miserable and keeps us from seeing reality and truth and beauty, which is God. And he's here to help us see God and get to God and be happy. And I didn't say it very well, but I said it. And the most amazing thing happened. I was like, that thread shut down. No one commented. No one said yes or no or what an idiot. It was like I hadn't said anything. Like I dropped a stone into a well. There wasn't even a plunk coming back. And I was like, I felt like everybody kind of looked at each other and rolled their eyes and shook their head sadly and tiptoed away from the crazy lady. So every so often I'll go back and look and I'm like, nope, still just sitting there. And I'm like, well, there it is.
Yep. Yep.
But that's what's real.
Right. Yeah.
That was me dying to self because I wasn't happy about it, but I would rather have died than done that before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to go there.
No, don't be sorry at all. That was fascinating stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's what was true. It's to me, being saved, it's like being saved is an easy shorthand.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, that the river could be looked at metaphorically there at the end in that way. to where, you know, the boy as he was slipped away. But yet again, you know, I see Flannery O'Connor as a realist, and it's hard for me to have the rest of the story and then have that last paragraph and say, well, that didn't really happen. But the thing is, you know, the thoughts that it spurs are what we're talking about.
And she is a Christian realist, remember? She said nothing makes sense outside of the incarnation. So, and when she was talking about a good man's hard to find, she's like, this isn't a story about something that really happened. This is, what was it?
Yeah, and I say the word realist, you know, and I understand that, you know, and I'm using that as my own description, you know, and I know she abhors being put in a box, but I'm just saying that when I read her stories, they're very realistic, you know, realistic. This is just, you know, she's describing things that are happening. She's describing people, what they observe. You know, there's not a whole lot of, you know, well, I guess I don't want to say the omniscience, but I'm just saying that it's unfair in her stories to throw. She's not going to, you know. Boy, I'm not explaining myself well at all.
But no,
what I'm just saying is that the way that she's writing, everything is so real. The characters are real. The observations are real. And for her to throw in something that's not real would be out of place. But at the same time, she seems to be saying that this is a surface and there are things below the surface. But she's not specifically describing the things under the surface. You're sensing what's below the surface by what's happening.
Yeah.
By the reality of what's happening. And the reality of what's happening gives you a glimpse of what's below the surface. That's the best way I can describe how I feel reading her stuff. So when I'm reading The River and he drowns, you know, that's a sad thing for me because I feel like, well, he misunderstood. But at the same time, I do understand that the thoughts that stirs in me are what we, you and I, are talking about right now. And therein lies the value.
Well, and that to be sad about it is a valid reaction, because what made me more sad, actually, because like I say, by the time I got to that point, I wasn't reading it as realistic at all anymore, because I was just concerned with his inner motivations and what he understood the river to be. But what made me sad was the way his life had been up to that point. For a child of 4 or 5 to go, well, I guess they'll get up about 1. And so he's left. He'd like some ginger ale, but he can't get to the bottle opener, so he's left eating little things he can find. I mean, no one's taking care of this little kid. What's his life? He's not been ever treated as if he even matters.
Yeah.
Everything's a joke. And I know there are many families where the kids are kind of like that.
Yeah, no question.
But one thing I wanted to say is, looking at The Habit of Being again, she says, she's talking about a good man is hard to find. Oh, no, she says, she's talking about the whole book. So she says, I am mighty tired of reading reviews that call a good man brutal and sarcastic. The stories are hard, but they are hard because there is nothing harder or less sentimental than Christian realism. I believe that there are many rough beasts now slouching toward Bethlehem to be born, and that I have reported the progress of a few of them. And when I see these stories described as horror stories, I am always amused, because the reviewer always has hold of the wrong horror.
Wow.
I thought that was an interesting
point. It sure is. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah, I need to read that whole Habit of Being. And like you said, you kind of went through it slowly over the years, didn't you? Or over, I don't know how long a period of time, but you just read a letter here and there.
2 or 3 years, I'd read a little bit and go, oh, that's enough of that. But by the time I got done, like I said, because I knew she died young and it was obvious she was getting sick and all that, you've gotten so deep into her life that I was like, oh, don't die. I don't want to read the end. I was reading slower and slower and slower. And I kind of became a friend.
Yeah.
Wow. I felt like, I was like, oh, I'm looking forward to meeting her in heaven. Hopefully I'll make it there. Yeah. Well, if we can real quick go on to...
Yes. Yeah, we're running short on time, aren't we? But yeah,
Good Country People. To discuss three. But she says, this is a great introduction, I thought. She says, I spent the weekend in Connecticut with Caroline, Gordon Tate, and Sue Jenkins, friend of Mrs. Tate. They had a party at which the chief guests were dear old Malcolm Cowley and dear old Van Wyck Brooks. Dear old Van Wyck insisted I read a story at which horror-stricken looks appeared on the faces of both Caroline and Sue. Read the shortest one, they both screamed. I read A Good Man is Hard to Find, and Mr. Brooks later remarked to Miss Jenkins that it was a shame someone with so much talent should look upon life as a horror story. Malcolm was very polite and asked me if I had a wooden leg.
Oh, man.
She's so funny.
Yes,
and she's
so,
she really sees the irony in everything.
Yeah, that is hilarious.
Yeah. It was pretty hilarious. So, yeah.
Well, let's
me,
yeah. Oh, sorry.
Good Country People is just, it's so much of it is so funny.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. Yeah. So go ahead and you wanted to read some of it.
Oh,
please do.
To me, the very first, most of the first paragraph shows her power of description so well. Mm-hmm. Besides the neutral expression that she wore when she was alone, Mrs. Freeman had two others, forward and reverse, that she used for all her human dealings. Her forward expression was steady and driving like the advance of a heavy truck. Her eyes never swerved to left or right, but turned as the story turned. As if they followed a yellow line down the center of it. She seldom used the other expression because it was not often necessary for her to retract a statement. But when she did, her face came to a complete stop. There was an almost imperceptible movement of her black eyes, during which they seemed to be receding, and then the observer would see that Mrs. Freeman, though she might stand there as real as several grain sacks thrown on top of each other, was no longer there in spirit. As for getting anything across to her when this was the case, Mrs. Hopewell had given it up. She might talk her head off. Mrs. Freeman could never be brought to admit herself wrong on any point. She would stand there, and if she could be brought to say anything, it was something like, "Well, I wouldn't have said it was, and I wouldn't have said it wasn't." Or letting her gaze range over the top kitchen shelf where there was an assortment of dusty bottles, she might remark, I see you ain't ate many of them figs you put up last summer.
Mm-hmm.
I butchered that, but there you go. But you get this beautiful picture of Mrs. Freeman as just this immovable object. I loved the several grain sacks thrown on each other.
Yep.
You can't shift them.
Yeah. Yep. I highlighted several things for hilarity in this story, just because they were funny. The reason for her keeping them so long was that they were not trash. They were good country people.
Yeah.
That made me chuckle. She was talking about these servants that they had hired. And
Mrs. Hopewell.
Yeah. Woman, do you ever look inside? Do you ever look inside and see what you are not? God.
Yeah.
That made me laugh too.
I loved that.
I chuckled a lot during this story. Another one. She looked at nice young men as if she could smell their stupidity.
It's Joy, right? Or Olga.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, this story is funny because it's a daughter living with her widowed mother, and the mother thinks of her as a child, but she's really 32.
Mm-hmm.
And she's gone on. The mother spends all her time. She's kind of like the grandmother. She's very superficial. She always likes to label people, well, they're good country people, or they're not. And Holga, or Joy, changed her name legally to Holga because... it was ugly. And she's also become an atheist while she was away at school.
Right. She's become an atheist while she was away at school, and she's very educated. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So she scorns everyone.
Yeah, and I highlighted this one, too. As a child, she had sometimes been subject to feelings of shame, but education had removed the last traces of that as a good surgeon scrapes for cancer. She would no more have felt it over what he was asking than she would have believed in his Bible. Yeah.
Yep.
So,
and then it says, Mrs. Hopewell never understands what Joy is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
She'll just smile at her.
Yep.
Going, I don't know what to say. No. So you've got these three characters. You've got Mrs. Freeman, who's just, she knows what she knows. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Hopewell, who's very superficial and just tries to get along. And are you good country people or not? And then you've got Holga, Joy,
mm-hmm.
who's rejecting her name, rejecting herself. And names really mean something in this one.
Yeah.
Which I didn't think about until the Bible salesman shows up one day.
Mm-hmm.
A young man with a big suitcase full of Bibles, you know. And his name is Manly Pointer. And I just... And until they follow that cliche where later he and Holga find themselves in the barn in the straw,
yeah,
you don't think about it. And I went, oh, my. And I told Tom, and we just sat there and laughed and laughed. And Holga has a wooden leg because there was an accident when she was a 10-year-old. And so this is her secret shame.
Yeah.
It's her leg.
Right, right. Yeah, and then she, her and the
young
Bible.
Man stays to dinner.
Yep.
And he's good country people, as he tells Mrs. Hopewell. Although what I liked is when he starts trying to sell her the Bible,
mm-hmm.
and he says, Mrs. Hopewell, he began, using her name in a way that sounded almost intimate, I know you believe in Christian service. Well, yes, she murmured. I know, he said, and paused, looking very wise with his head cocked on one side, that you're a good woman, friends have told me. Mrs. Hopewell never liked to be taken for a fool. What are you selling? She asked. And I was like, now there's some of the real Mrs. Hopewell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Get on with it.
Uh-huh.
What are you selling? But yet, he does take her in.
Yeah.
And so she asks him to stay for dinner.
Right, right. So, yeah, so Joy and this Bible salesman find themselves alone together.
Yeah, and they make an appointment.
Yeah.
an assignation, I guess you would say.
Right, right.
They wind up in the loft of the barn.
Mm-hmm. Yep, kissing a little bit. And then he wants to see her take her leg off.
Yeah.
Which, you know, goes up to her knee. And, this is interesting. And then, mm-hmm. you know, she finally consents, and she does it, and then he takes her leg. Won't give it back.
I know.
Yeah.
And at one point it says to show him where her leg was connected was like giving away her soul or mm-hmm. something.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see.
She likes to say she doesn't have any illusions, she tells him. She sees through to nothing.
Right.
Because nothing is all there is.
Yeah. It was like, let's see, losing her own life and finding it again miraculously in his. I was trying to find the specific sentence where she says how that makes her feel, because it's almost as if she's submitting to him. You know, by doing this, she's... you know, showing herself entirely to somebody else, and she's not want to do that.
Yeah, let's see.
Not seeing that
right
exact
after
sentence.
The thing about scraping the shame off, I thought. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Okay, it says, this boy, with an instinct that came from beyond wisdom, had touched the truth about her. When, after a minute, she said in a hoarse, high voice, "All right." It was like surrendering to him completely. It was like losing her own life and finding it again miraculously in his. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so then he goes ahead and takes the leg off.
Yeah, and then he takes the leg off, and then off he goes.
And he puts it in his big case.
Yeah. Like, wait a minute.
Yeah. So she's finally, you know, allowing herself some dependence on mm-hmm. someone, mm-hmm. and then he steals it. He
takes it.
And runs away. She's left to hop down on one leg. and he brags to her about taking somebody's glass eye one time.
Oh, wow.
And it's like he collects people's infirmities
mm-hmm.
and enjoys revealing them or something.
Yeah. I guess the world would be better off if we were all that simple, says Mrs. Hopewell at the end. He's like, wow.
Oh, and he takes her glasses, too.
Yeah.
Or he takes them off. I don't know if she finds them again, because she couldn't see at the end of it.
Oh, boy.
But one thing that I always thought was really interesting, because you go, what's the point of this story?
Mm.
But what happens is when she's like, well, wait a minute, but aren't you good country people? You give me my leg back. You really meant it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is in the moment of stress, she suddenly shows that deep down underneath all that stuff she found at school,
mm-hmm.
she is like her mother.
Right.
She is adhering to all the stuff she learned when she was little and but good country people. And he's just laughing at her. And what happens is he takes off his mask and goes, no, I'm not like that. Mm-hmm. I'm a jerk, basically. And then he says, let's see. And you needn't think you'll catch me because Pointer ain't really my name. I use a different name at every house I call at and don't stay nowhere long. And I'll tell you another thing, Olga, he said, using the name as if he didn't think much of it. You ain't so smart. I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born. And then the toast-colored hat disappeared down the hole, and the girl was left sitting on the straw in the dusty sunlight. She turned her churning face toward the opening. She saw his blue figure struggling successfully over the green speckled lake. So it's like he's walking on water.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and then because also Mrs. Freeman, because Mrs. Hopewell is like, he was so simple. They see him walking away over the pasture. They don't know what's happened. And she says, he was so simple, she said, but I guess the world would be better off if we were all that simple. Mrs. Freeman's gaze drove forward and just touched him before he disappeared under the hill. Then she returned her attention to the evil-smelling onion shoot she was lifting from the ground. Some can't be that simple, she said. I know I never could. And she's Freeman.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And when he's struggling over the... You think about it and you go, wait a minute, he's walking over the water like Jesus? Wait, hold on. And then you think about it and you go, you know, in the midst of this hilarious story, she's had... Holga has all her pretensions stripped away. So what's left is the real person underneath, and then she's got to deal with that person
mm-hmm.
and the results of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Which is also what an encounter with Christ does. Yeah. Not that I could say that kid is really, you know, Christ-like, but...
Yeah, well, that's true, and that is a similarity with a good man that's hard to find in the juxtaposition between the grandmother and the misfit and how they kind of mm-hmm. swapped roles, mm-hmm. even though... You know, she was the snake. And, you know, in this case, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, really
and
interesting.
And that point that you know, about Holga Joy.
Mm-hmm.
But Holga, who's renamed herself and remade herself, and she submits to him completely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing about when people go, this horrible thing happened, but without that, I never would have known what was real. Or I'm a better person because of it, or, you know, and you see that explained in all kinds of ways, but sometimes those encounters with Christ are burning. They hurt. We're ashamed because we really see what's real.
Yeah.
And, which is why, and I hate that we always come back to confession, but maybe I don't hate it, but that's why confession is useful mm-hmm. because you're forced to kind of keep examining yourself.
Right. Yeah.
And ask for help in seeing where is it that I'm layering on stuff that I shouldn't, so I can ignore what's real.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
God comes in all kinds of guises, I guess.
He does.
Or enlightenment certainly does, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Well, these stories are just something else. And I mean, we could go on for a long, long time.
Yes, we could.
But I, unfortunately, am almost out of time.
Oh, my gosh. I know. Oh, my gosh. I'm happy, too. But.
But, yes. So, yeah. Again, we've been reading out of A Good Man It's Hard to Find in Other Stories. And she's got more than that. I can't recall the name of another collection, but isn't there one out that's called The Collected Stories of Flannery O'Connor that has everything?
Yeah, that's what I have, actually. I have The Complete Stories.
Okay. Yeah.
I had to go find, you sent me the list of what you had in A Good Man Is Hard to Find, so I had to mark it.
Okay.
And go, oh, okay. Yeah. But yeah, she has, but they don't have it named by the collections. Let's see. This has also a first book that was never published before called The Geranium, A Collection of Short Stories.
Okay.
It has A Good Man Is Hard to Find. It has Wise Blood. That was her first book.
Okay.
Which was written, published before A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And then, gosh, there was another one. Let's see. I have to kind of look through the foreword to get them. But, The Violent Buried Away. Wasn't that one?
Yeah, there's another one on Audible as well, and I can't recall what that one's called, but I think Audible has two of her collections. This one,
yeah,
and then another one, and I can't recall the name of it.
Yeah, and I didn't stop and look. Well, it's anybody looking at Wikipedia. We can find it and put it up, I guess. And she had written another novel, maybe, right before she died.
She wrote a novel. I didn't know that.
She died in her hospital bed. She was scribbling away, fixing stories and stuff for publications.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, oh, yeah. Wrote letters from her hospital bed, like the day before she died. Her mother found postcards and stuff on her hospital bedside, and so she sent them off to the people that they were meant for. And
oh, wow.
She died young of lupus,
okay,
which was a family thing.
I found that other collection. It's called Everything That Rises Must Converge.
That's it.
And then they do have Wise Blood as well, narrated by Bronson Pinchot.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
I don't know if I could listen to it. I guess that would get you the first taste of it, and then you might want to reread it.
Yeah.
Or not. Maybe it just comes to you okay that way, too.
I don't know. Yep.
Oh, well, yes. And they're hard stories to read, but it's funny. Once you kind of dive in, it's like that first dip into the pool. Then you could just read them and go, wow, this one really hit me. I don't know why. And just reread it and see what comes to you. Because if you kind of have in mind where she's coming from and what she's trying to do, you'll see things or you won't. And I think she'd probably be happy enough with that.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too.
But she's an extraordinary writer, no matter what. Like,
yeah,
even
no
the people
question.
Who hated her would go, somebody with so much talent, they're writing these, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no question.
So, we're out of time.
Right, we are.
But next, we're going to go to something much less.
Much lighter, yes. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Yes! I can't wait.
Fantastic. And then is your selection official for the next book?
Yes, after we will go also to something that's a little easier to read. Well, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's more horror-ish. Coraline.
By Neil Gaiman.
Neil Gaiman.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a terrific book.
Yeah.
So, good.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, we'll see you next time, everybody.
That's right. Have a great couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Fun.
Yep.
Yeah, I feel like I've rambled through most of that, but I'm just like, gosh, how do I talk about this? I don't know how to talk about this.
Me too. And they'll just have to put up with it or not. They'll have to go read those stories and then listen, or the five people who love Flannery O'Connor will listen.
Maybe it'll make just somebody like Jesse try to read them.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
And I realized that about two-thirds of the way through, or a third of the way through, I had stopped going, no, just listen to him and then talk. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea if I just stepped all over you or jumped in there.
No, geez, good heavens.
I have no idea.
No, you did not. All is
I got
well.
Excited.
And that's great. So.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And the best way to, in fact, we forgot to say, but the best way to do these is by talking to somebody else. Like when you saying something and I went, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
That's when I get the most out of it.
Yeah, me too. I got some stuff out of this today that I hadn't thought about. And that's interesting. That thing about, you know, in Good Man, how they swap roles. That's fascinating. And I've just been thinking about that ever since he said it. I'm sitting here going, wow. It really did.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? And the thing is, that's like a deeper truth, isn't it? And I mean, that's kind of what we encounter. I know that, you know, I struggle with people saying, you know, that God causes all these bad things to happen.
Oh, he doesn't.
But yet, the fact that good things come out of it is true. you know, a bad thing could happen and that good things can happen out of it.
Right.
It's true. And I think that's where God is. And
we didn't make that point.
Yeah. But I'm just, you know, trying to think about that now, I don't think it makes it not rain.
Yeah. Bad things happen because of the natural world or because, we choose like the misfit to do something awful anyway.
Yeah.
And sometimes we do good through our bad, even though it isn't good for us. But God will, that's what I always pray for bad circumstances like that is, you know, show me the good. Mm-hmm. You will bring good out of it. You know, did Christ have to be crucified? No. But because of original sin, he did. The theology on that, the thinking of the real high thinkers, is that if Adam and Eve had made the right choice, Christ still would have come at the right time to enlighten us, but it wouldn't have had to be like that.
I see.
We wouldn't have needed all that other stuff.
Yeah,
and God went, you know what? Okay, I'm going to have to do it like this now. But that's all right. I'll do it. Mm-hmm. I love you that much.
Yeah.
Which makes it, at first I was kind of struggled with that. And then I went, well, there's the Trinity. We'd have to get to know them somehow. You don't get the Holy Spirit till you've got Christ come to redeem you. Mm-hmm. Okay. I could see that that could have had a much better, easier way to do it. But we screwed it up.
Yeah. Fascinating.
So, which makes it more beautiful.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's cool. It's cool to have a writer, you know, and then in fiction can make you think about this stuff. And how fiction can do that is remarkable. And and again, you know, I think, you know, as a writer, if you set out to do that, I think that you fail. I really do. Yeah. I think that stuff comes out.
Oh, I meant to say, that's where all those crappy Christian movies and books come from.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something I meant to say, too, is I wish you were recording this. You could just tap it on the
Oh, actually, I am. I'm recording it in one way.
Oh, throw this on the end.
I think I will. Okay.
Because that's the thing. I meant to say that is, Yeah, because they were like, I'm going to show everybody this. Well, no, just tell a good story and it'll be in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Well, and that's like the thing about the river. Mm-hmm. When I was talking, I've been going, well, but you know, that's true. When you go in that river and you said the thing about, you know, you're changed, it's a new life and everything. And I went, you know, when I was reading the story to myself, I was going, this is the sappy. Yeah, it's true. But oh my gosh, it's the sappiest stuff ever. And you know, she was writing it that way because like you said, there's all those Protestants there and she's heard it her whole life.
Yeah.
But there's that underlying truth too. That's the river that takes us there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, thank you, Scott. That's the thing of the talking, the synergy that comes from it. So,
yeah. That's why I enjoy doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
And what will we find in The Wrath of Khan?
Oh,
I can only
imagine. Ricardo Montalban's chest, for one thing. I understand it's all real, so now I can really enjoy it. And that wig, come on. That hair. And that sincerity
that's
from
right.
hell's depths, I spit at thee. Of course, we'll have Heather with us, so that'll be, we'll see what
right.
she pulls out of that.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, well, now quit recording.
Okay.